And I said, I understand that you're thinking about deserting and leaving your wife and children. Well, he told about this woman where he worked, that they went out and just happened to sit down at the same table during the lunch hour. And they found it pleasant. They laughed and talked. And so they, by chance, ate together again and again and again, and it kept on. And one day she said to him, are you happily married? And he said, I got to thinking about it, and I realized that, well, really not happily married. So from that time, things just went on from bad to worse until now he's going to go live with that woman who would ask him, are you happily married? And who would cultivate that friendship and deliberately take away the husband and father from that family. You don't know the ones I'm talking about. I haven't told you a terrible lot. Can you answer with pretty well convinced in your own mind that you know? If he left that wife and children and went to live with that woman who would deliberately take him away, do you think he was happy? Is that going to be a much happier place? He said, I just decided, I'm not happy. When we talk about a happy home, we're not talking about constant hilarity and loud laughing. No, I don't think there's all that much fun in being a father and a husband where there's a responsibility to provide for several people to pay the bills. I suppose when he'd come in tired in the evening, one would be crying, and maybe soon another would be, and maybe a couple of them would have a little fight of some kind. I think maybe there would be something that would hinder his rest in his recliner if he came in the evening to four or five children, young. He'd get a little taste of what his wife would have regularly as she cared for them. Happiness? Well, he said, I got to thinking about it and realized that really, no, I wasn't happy. And what do you mean by happiness? Do you mean fortunate and blessed? Five healthy children? A faithful wife? He'd been considered a member of the church. If you are indeed respected as a member of the church, that's a pretty good name, a reputation. And good names rather be chosen than great riches. But he's thinking about losing the confidence of his brethren by walking out on five little folks who need a daddy so very much. If for nothing else, they need him to bring in a paycheck. They need something to eat. They need shoes on their feet. They need somebody to provide. But he wants a happier life than he has as a father. And with all that responsibility and all that noise and all that crying, and he's going to just brush his hands of the whole thing and walk out. I think a man is cheap. Indeed. He's not much of a man. He's more of an animal just following the line of least resistance. It's evil that brings about divorces. But people give such little thought to the consequences and allow themselves to be swept away from a family situation by such trivial things. We've said that fornication is the cause of divorce. Adultery is the cause of it. Or the result of it, either way you want to look at it. A man proves himself immoral and then his home is broken. Or a man becomes an alcoholic or a dope addict of one kind or another and his money has to go for his drugs. That habit is a selfish habit. It seems to me that it is a very, very selfish habit. because he gets payday, and by the time he gets home, the money's all gone. He's gambled a little, he spent some on liquor, and when he gets drunk, then he'll just give it away. But he comes home and doesn't have anything to buy the necessities. Oh, that's a pathetic thing. I want to mention tonight humanism again, as we have mentioned it before. I want to mention it in connection with this divorce evil. Why are there so many divorces? Do you know why? What has happened that there are so many in our generation? I believe we could lay the terrible blight on our nation at the feet of the atheists who have organized themselves into the humanist society. And they've gone to work through such organizations as the NOW, the National Organization of Women, and the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU. There are some powerful organizations in our country that are, of course, altogether for atheists, for people who believe that there is no God, there is no judgment to be expected, there is no heaven, there's no hell. They think that the greatest creature on earth is a human being, and he makes his own laws. Whatever is right to him is right to him. Everybody has a right to his own judgment, and he makes his own decisions. And no such thing as sin. It's just a matter of judgment, a matter of human judgment. And if it's right for him, it's right for him. It wouldn't necessarily be right for somebody else, but it's right for him if he thinks it is, because he is his own God. He's the lawmaker for himself. The Humanist Society organized in the 1930s and came out with the Humanist Manifesto number 1 about the time I was getting grown. Then they came out in the 1870s with the Humanist Manifesto number 2, and they boast of their unbelief and they see no evidence of God. Look in a world like ours and see no evidence of a creator. The heavens declare the glory of God. The human body, they're learning more and more about it in all these studies and research groups. They're learning more and more about the body. And they learn that just a little bit too much or not enough of a certain chemical in the brain may do terrible things. But there are little glands in our bodies to regulate the chemistry of the blood and the chemistry of the body generally. Very important little parts here and there out through our physical makeup. We are fearfully and wonderfully made, and the more people learn about, the more doctors and scientists learn about the human body, the more marvelous it becomes. The human body is not here by chance. With eyes made out of dust that can see and recognize color and judge distance, and ears that can hear and recognize the direction from which the sound comes, and so many have a wonderful ability to recognize tone and pitch and so on, and to harmonize. The ear is a wonderful thing. It's made out of dust. Everything about us is made out of dust. We're not made out of gold or platinum or silver. We're not made out of the precious metals at all. Made out of dust, out of the cheapest things. But we are fearfully and wonderfully made, designed to our advantage. A man is just about blind if he can look with his own mind at his own body and can't see that it was designed. And can't see from nature's beauties with its pastel colors that there's somebody that loves beauty and somebody designed this beautiful earth. Flowers that bloom and birds that sing. Atheists can destroy, but they don't have anything positive to give. The National Education Association has been dominated in recent years by the humanist movement. Many in Congress are humanists. Many of the judges of our land are. Many of the lawyers are. There are good men that are lawyers. And many fine young men in recent years have been training in that particular field of endeavor. And as I go in meetings, often I'm permitted to eat in a lawyer's home, in another lawyer's home. Very, evidently very devout and active in the work of the church. But there's so many of the atheistic crowd that they have hindered a great deal the reputation of lawyers. I would that something could be done to defeat humanists, and I don't want them to destroy us by instilling questions in our mind. A 3-year-old can ask questions adults can't answer. And an atheist, if he's a man to, can just go around and fighting and destroying and opposing the things that are holy and righteous, trying to destroy the church and push it completely to the back burner, out of existence if possible. It's time for us to fight a good fight and war a good warfare and earnestly contend for the faith. We need not back off as cowards from atheists who are seeking to destroy the faith of all. One thing they have done is introduce into many public schools over the nation a course called sex education. And to hear them explain their idea sounds maybe like it might be worthwhile, but what they are doing is trying to teach the boys and girls that adultery and fornication would be all right, but trying to show them how they can avoid the consequences. Sex education has been one of the ways of wrecking the morals of our nation, because the things that are taught in such courses generally are things so completely opposite to that passage I read from Matthew 19. If I had read from Mark 10, it would have been the same principle exactly, except it states it as well from the woman's point of view. If she puts away her husband, then she's guilty. And that same law is found in Luke 16, 18, in Matthew 5, 20, 31 and 32, in 1 Corinthians 7, 39, and the first paragraph of Romans 7, and in Ephesians 5, the marriage law is stated over and over again. One of the often repeated statements in our Bible is first found in Genesis 2. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall be one flesh. That's found again in Mark 10, in Matthew 19, in Ephesians 5. The same, practically word for word each time. The Lord wants us to see the beauty of holiness, and particularly now, the thing we're talking about, a regard for that which is holy in regard to the marriage law. What are the things that are breaking up the home? Humanists, unbelief, a denial of God. A man may not come out and say, I've become an atheist. He may be a nominal member of the church. But I believe that man that I told about, who was about to leave his wife and 5 children, little children, I believe that down deep he didn't much believe that there is a hell that's especially prepared for whoremongers, for fornicators, adulterers. Whether you look at the list of people that are definitely to be lost in 1 Corinthians 6, or Galatians 5, or Colossians 3, or Revelation 21, expect to find at the head of the list fornication. It's found in each list. In every list. And at the head of the list. I don't know what difference it makes whether you put murder on down in the list or in fornication first, but for some reason, it's always fornication at the start. Neither fornicators, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, And the idolaters were fornicators because in the idolatrous worship, fornication was part of it. But he put them at the first. The works of the flesh are manifest, which are these. Fornication, and then he goes ahead, and there are three or four words. There are four words before he gets to another subject. Lasciviousness, uncleanness, as well as fornication and adultery. In so many ways, the Lord tells us this is an evil to be avoided. It brings evil results. It grows out of evil things, evil conversations, evil conduct. It's not a little thing. I was in a meeting a few years ago where the able preacher, for whom I had come to have such a high regard, was very pleasant during the meeting. Before the week was over, I went into the home of a young couple who's, I'd known his parents since before they married. And he had some questions to ask, but he didn't identify any particular reason for his questions, but he wanted to know how I felt about a man and his wife going in with another man and his wife and having swimming parties and dressing as people do at the pools. He said, "Do you consider that a danger, a serious thing?" And I told him, "Indeed I do." I didn't know he was talking about the preacher that I was seeing each night and preaching to each night and for whom I'd had such respect. But later I found that man in Alabama and I visited in his home and he reminded me of the questions he'd asked in that Tennessee meeting. And he was talking about the preacher. He didn't say he was talking about the preacher, but the preacher and his wife would have an elder and his wife over, and they lived in a subdivision where there was a pool provided. And when you bought the house, you bought a right to free use of the pool. And you could have your friends come over. So a little while after the meeting in which I was doing the preaching there, the preacher and somebody else's wife took up with one another. To the shame of the cause of Christ. You know, he had meetings canceled. He had numbers of them scheduled with churches here and there. And he resented that no little. Because when he was caught, he did go forward and make confession. And he meant then, if he just come clean with it and say, "Yes, I'm guilty, I'm sorry, and I promise not to do that again," he meant then for the whole brotherhood to accept him freely now and use him just as they used to in meetings. A bird with a broken wing never flies as high again. There's something about sin that leaves its mark. A scar is there. Suppose that man, that preacher who had read the Bible and had preached so many excellent sermons and had been preaching for 20 years, he preached and he preached and he preached and then became unfaithful to his own wife and didn't even see any danger in dressing, he and his wife dressing as people do in pools, and inviting over this man who's due to be a leader in the house of the Lord, he and his wife, and they come dressed, and together they show no modesty. I'm sure he must not have been preaching against the things that lead to lascivious. That would be lasciviousness if I know what lasciviousness is. Lascivious dress, lascivious conversation, the lascivious dance. Anything of the lascivious order is in the direction of the actual overt act of fornication. But he somehow just couldn't, evidently hadn't seen that. But there was trouble, problems, that grew out of that kind of behavior and that kind of careless thinking. And he wondered why people, all of the churches, wanted to cancel his meeting. It's been some years now, but I wouldn't recommend him now as a gospel preacher. I think a man needs to take a seat somewhere and hope maybe God will be merciful to him and save him. If he's brought the church of the Lord to an open shame, when he's had every opportunity to know better, there's something wrong with his heart. Seriously wrong. I believe that sinners can be forgiven by God. After mentioning the fornicators and the thieves and the drunkards in 1 Corinthians 6, in verse 11, Paul said, "Such were some of you, but you've been washed and sanctified and justified." It can be done. And we're not meaning to say tonight that if you sinned in any way like that, there's no hope for you. It's a merciful God that would offer you pardon and the hope of heaven again. But only if there is that repentance, genuine repentance. And God may know when the heart has made that turn and may accept that sinner as a humble, penitent sinner. When the rest of us are not all that sure, and there's still the shadow and the question in our minds. But we can promise you that God will save. If you want to be saved tonight, you need to come and make the good confession and be baptized. If you haven't been, you need to confess your faults before men and genuinely repent of the sins that are brought to question. If the church has been brought to shame publicly by your conduct. If there's something we can help you do, we'd like to do it. While we stand together and sing, "Come If You Will." And about the divorce evil, and certainly it deserves. Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? And he answered and said unto them, "Have ye not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, For this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore there are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder." And they say unto him, "Why did Moses then command to give a writing of divorcement, and to put her away?" He saith unto them, "Moses, because of the hardness of your heart, suffered you to put away your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife, except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery, And whoso marrieth her, which is put away, doth commit a sin that would keep one out of heaven. Very clear, the Bible is, that neither fornicators, nor adulterers, nor murderers, nor drunkards, nor thieves shall inherit the kingdom. It's neither nor. It cuts away our hope of heaven. Of course, people can repent and can be forgiven by looking to the Lord and His law of pardon. But the sin is no little thing, the sin of divorce, the sin of breaking up the home tie. What God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. The tie is one that God considers binding. And He doesn't consider a little thing for the tie to be broken. Divorce is so common in our land. In some areas, 50% of the marriages break. Half of them. That's a sad thing. When a divorce comes, the man in the family suffers heartache sooner or later. Sorrow comes to him. It comes also to her. No matter who may be guilty or who not guilty. Oftentimes, when we talk about the innocent party, it might be a little hard to prove that there is an innocent party in many divorces. The guilt may not be the guilt of fornication, but there may have been other things involved that I think both in each couple should work diligently to try to make the marriage a success. And if you know that that's a marriage-destroying sin, a home-destroying sin, we ought to leave it alone. I wish I knew what to say that would have some influence for the child that's left with his home torn up in his face. So many of America's criminals are products of the broken home. It's not just the mother and the father and the children that suffer. The grandparents suffer. The parents, her parents and his parents, if they still live, they're heartbroken when there's such a thing as a divorce. There likely are some in the audience that have had occasion to go through that experience. Your own spouse, no longer faithful, no longer with you. Or your son or daughter has had that experience. But let us remind ourselves that the church itself is made to suffer. When members of the church violate the marriage law and bring reproach upon themselves and their own families, if they have been associated with the church, it makes a scar. The Lord loved the church and gave Himself for it that He might sanctify and cleanse it by the washing of water by the word, that He might present it to Himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. We make a mark and a scar on the church and its good name when there is a divorce on the part of people who been there in the services time after time after time, and then divorce. I do not know how many gospel preachers have gotten divorce in my generation, your generation, and in immorality, the home is destroyed. But it's true. It's amazing, but it's true that some, they know the teaching, they know what He said about fornicators and adulterers and what the destiny is, and then it turns out that he has taken up with a third party and the home is broken or threatened. There have been some that I've known quite well that turned out that way. And some of those men that I'm thinking of were able preachers, abundantly able, and much appreciated. And when I've learned it in a few cases, I've been shocked. I don't know what word to use, the word amazed or shocked. But after all, the preacher's soul is no more important than any other's. When we violate the marriage law, we sin against the Christ who died for us. In 1 Corinthians 6, the whole last half of the chapter is taken up with a discussion of the seriousness of the sin of fornication in an eternal reward that belongs to citizens of the kingdom. And fornication is just in the list, and a closely related sin, the sin of adultery. Those two words are in the list along with the ones others that we have mentioned, such as thieves and drunkards. But the last half of the chapter is taken to tell us that instead of fornication being just a minor thing or a misdemeanor, it singles it out as being especially grievous. I'm not in any position to go through the catalog of sin tonight and tell you, now here's the most serious and here's one not quite as bad and on down until there are little sins that don't amount to much. I can't classify sins like that. But in this sixth chapter of 1 Corinthians, he, in the 13th verse, beginning in the middle of the verse, now the body is not for fornication, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. And God hath both raised up the Lord, and will also raise up us by his own power. Know ye not that your bodies are the members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? God forbid. What? Know ye not that he which is joined to a harlot is one body? For two, saith he, shall be one flesh. But he that is joined unto the Lord is one spirit. Flee fornication. Every sin that a man doeth is without the body, but he that committeth fornication sinneth against his own body. What? Know ye not that your body is the temple of the Holy Ghost which is in you, which ye have of God, and you're not your own, for you're bought with a price? Therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. I don't know how he could have made a stronger appeal than he did in that passage. He said, you belong to the Lord. He bought you and paid for you. You're his servant. You owe him your very life and your very existence. Every good and every perfect gift comes down from above, from the Father of lights. And the question is asked in this same Corinthian letter, what have ye that ye did not receive? When we bow our heads to the Father and say thank you, we have a lot of reasons for saying it. Love for God would keep us from violating the marriage law and other laws as well that he's given. He said, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. Now, one of his commandments would be flee fornication. Avoid adultery and such things. Shun the very appearance of evil. The Lord deals with these things. So we sin against God. We sin against our own parents. We sin against our own children. Our own marriage partner. We sin grievously against those that we are closest to when we are guilty of that sin. And there's no reason. There's no reward from the sin that's all that great. Some years ago, I was in another county in North Alabama in a meeting, a very encouraging meeting in the spring. And when it came time to close the meeting,
We wished we had more time because interest had built up and we felt like it was, but I had a meeting scheduled for the very next week. And well, they said, could you come back in the fall? And I said, we picked a time in which I could, and I did go back for a second meeting that year. Now, in the spring, in that happy meeting, I visited, as is typical for men in meetings. I visited one night in a home where they had two children, a son and a daughter, in about the junior high age, to visit. When I went back that fall and learned that that man had put away that wife and those two children and was living with another woman, a woman with whom he'd been riding to work for some time. I thought it was a fine family. My visit in the home was very, very pleasant. They were there attending the meeting regularly, had been attending services, I understand, regularly, taking active part in the church. But from the spring till the fall, what a change. Now, though, that son and daughter didn't have a father living with them. People in the church told me some things about him. He'd always been one who thought that he shouldn't be expected to do housework. That was a woman's work. So he never dared wash dishes or take any part like that in little chores around the house that he thought were her jobs, her work. But some of them, in telling the story, said it's different now. With his new wife, he's used quite freely in the kitchen and about the house in things that he had said were woman's work. I want to ask you, and all this time I've been taking is just to lead up to this question. I want to ask you if you think, without knowing any more, can you pretty well answer in your own mind, was he happier in this new situation? Was there any advantage to him or anybody under the sun? It's not a very happy and comfortable thought, is it, when a man proves unworthy of his own children? Unworthy of that honorable title of father? I believe the sinner suffers in the long run more than anybody else. He takes out the very basis of happiness, the very foundation of it. Divorce, people just jump up and break their home ties, take off. They do not find something better down yonder. I believe the man suffered a great loss. I think of how unfortunate it was for the children and what a sad thing for his wife, for her husband to prove unworthy and unfaithful. But I still say that the very sinner himself, I don't know what faults his wife may have had. I don't know all that was involved. But I do say that when a man divorces, he suffers, she suffers, the children suffer. Anybody that's acquainted with them and feels an intimate tie toward them suffers, and the church suffers. When my granddaddy Lee died, I was 4. And my Uncle Will was in his early teens, and he came to live with us. He was my brother there for a time. He stayed at our house and went to school for a little while. But he got restless to go get a job where two of his brothers lived and worked in southern Illinois. So he left, got a good job, and was being promoted rapidly and getting more and more pay, and the brothers were proud of him. He married a girl he hadn't known long at all. He didn't know her. He married a stranger. Uncle Finus, the oldest one of the brothers, said, "Will, how did you think it, what made you think it could work when you didn't even know Effie? You hadn't known her. You'd hardly met her, just spur-of-the-moment affair." He said, it's a big world, and if it doesn't work, I'll take my hat. I'm not bragging about my relatives now. He said, if it doesn't work, I'll take my hat. It didn't work, and he took his hat. But the reason that home didn't work, the primary reason that I know of, was that Uncle Will began drinking. And he became a slave of drink. He was not one who could drink a little and stop and carry on his work, but when he got started to drinking, he just drank and drank until his money was gone. And his job left. And his self-respect was gone. He didn't take his hat, as he said, until he had three children. But he did take his hat. He left. A slave of alcohol. And for the rest of his life, he was more like a hobo or a tramp or some person that would be a liability on society. He meant so much to me when he was there, enough older than I as my big brother, until he was so patient with me and good to me. He had a big, tender heart, and I thought a lot of Uncle Will. I idolized him almost when I was that little boy and he was living with us. But he lived to be, I guess, 60. But I don't think he had one day that he could really call a happy day after he took his hat. You can take your hat, but there's nowhere to go from the awareness that you have three children you don't take care of and you're not there to be their daddy. You have three children and a wife, and yet here you are over here unworthy and in living in rebellion against God and a blot on society. I don't think the alcoholic is the happier man. I don't think the fornicator is the happier man. I don't believe the thief who has what he has, but dishonestly, and he knows he doesn't have a right to it, I don't believe he's the happier man. Sin doesn't bring the happiness that a man looks for. A thief at least does get to have what he picks up. He has some treasure to show for what he's done. What does the blasphemer have? And what does the man who tells his dirty joke get? The vulgar talking man, the man with a filthy mouth. You know, the Bible talks about filthy communication. And it talks about uncleanness. The dirty mind, the filthy talk, the unclean type character. The Bible uses the word unclean and the word filthy and corrupt communication. I wish that those of us who are sitting here tonight sober and blessed by so many things could see that sin is sin, that it's to be despised. Abhor that which is evil. Eschew evil, shun it, as you would a dreaded disease. It's a terrible thing in its influence. The divorce evil is an evil, and it's brought about by evil. Not brought about by good. A woman crying called me one time where I was living and trying to preach. Her husband was asking for a divorce. He'd found a woman on the job where he was working that he decided he wanted. He had a family of children just about as close together in age as possible. And that mother was a very busy woman. If you put about five children with one mother, all of them young, it's a busy, busy place. I went right to the man and talked with him, and I had a chance to talk with him on my very first effort. I found a chance to talk with him privately.